Thanks, Ben. Those
So
of you
for
just joining, I have no camera, but that's cool. We will take approval of the minutes, please.
but just I want to note real quick that for attendance, I have all
Perfect.
present. However, it looks like Alder Harrington McKinney is not here, and Matt Fair is excused. Let me just double check.
That is what I'm seeing as well.
All right, that concludes the.
Okay, let's take a motion for the June 5th meeting minutes. Motion by Alder Dean-Anina, second by Alder Uguer. Any opposed or comments? Say now. Hearing none, we'll approve by unanimous consent. Great. It's a Monday evening for us, so we're a little discombobulated. I'll speak for myself and my camera. Public comment. Ben, do we have anything?
I believe Lynette will chime in on that.
Okay, great. Lynette, do we have any public comment?
Nope.
Great. Okay. Next up, disclosures and recusals. Does anyone have anything they'd like to disclose or recuse themselves from? We don't have any further action items on the agenda, so let me know if you have anything you want to talk about. Seeing none, we are moving with speed tonight. Next up, let's review the draft tax credit RFP.
I will try to keep us moving with speed. Just going to share my screen here. And make you all a little bit bigger. There we go. So, first and foremost, I just want to thank everyone for the flexibility and getting together tonight to review this. It's something we do every year, but still is important to bring back to committee to have eyes on it. So we're just here for discussion. As we mentioned last month, we are coming up on the release of our 2025 Affordable Rental Housing Development Tax Credit RFP. So attached to tonight's agenda, there was a memo of some of the changes to the RFP. There was also an attachment to the RFP draft itself. I'm just going to go through a really, really quick PowerPoint, and then pull up those documents separately just to touch on a few key highlights within them. So should just be a little bit of time here. So first and foremost, just a little bit of background. So this isn't, as I said, an annual funding process. This is something the Community Development Division releases every single year. And this is the 12th consecutive year that we have released this Affordable Housing Fund Tax Credit RFP. This year, we do anticipate having at least $10 million in affordable housing funds that are available to allocate through the RFP. And this process stretches every year from July really through January and beyond. So July is when we have released that RFP. As you'll see as we get into the calendar a little bit later, there are several important steps, both for proposers to the RFP, for staff, and then for committee members, and then ultimately council to make final funding decisions that do stretch into December, and then some processes finalizing in early 2026 as well. I will upload this PowerPoint again to the agenda just to make sure that everyone has access to it. There are a couple links within it, so I just want to make everyone aware. As far as policy guidance for the RFP, one of the things that we noted in the changes is we have several guiding documents, is what I like to call them as a city. Many of them touch on aspects of what we do when allocating funding through this RFP. So one of the things we did was, as a staff team, clearly consider what guiding documents we use to drive our requirements and our preferences and the philosophy of what we're doing within this RFP. So first we have, as this committee knows and has oversight over, the consolidated plan. So that's something that was before this committee a couple of months ago. It's something that we use to help guide the process. We also have the Housing Forward Initiative, which is the city's initiative as a whole, the Dane Forward 5-year plan to prevent and end homelessness, the City of Madison's Sustainability Plan, which was adopted last August, August of 2024, and then the city's area plans. So these are specialized large area plans that look at different areas of the city. There are 12 different ones that operate on a think it's 12, but operate on a 10-year cycle so that every area of the city is getting a plan update once every 10 years. And those ultimately tie into the city of Madison's comprehensive plan as well, Imagine Madison, which really is the large-scale guiding policy document that we have as a city. Most closely, though, this ties into Housing Forward. And I just want to name the four areas of Housing Forward, the four focus areas of that initiative. So, number one is to increase housing choice. Number two is to create affordable housing throughout the city. Number three is to combat displacement by supporting choices for people to stay in their homes. Through this, I like to say also stay in their neighborhoods potentially as well. And then work to end homelessness. So, the ways that we do that through this RFP. Is by using these funds through a competitive application process to preserve existing income and rent restricted housing units anywhere in the city. Units of housing that are already income and rent restricted are a critical supply of housing, and we want to make sure that those can be extended as long as possible. Those income and rent restrictions stay on them for as long as they possibly can. So we can use this RFP process to support that. To develop new affordable housing in parts of the city that currently have limited access to income and rent restricted housing. This is to facilitate geographic mobility for residents and increase overall choice. So again, that develop housing across the city, increase housing choices across the city. To develop new affordable housing in parts of the city where naturally occurring affordable housing already exists. And this is to improve housing stability and limit involuntary displacement of folks from their neighborhoods, while also still having a focus in this RFP on areas that are extremely well served by transit. And then finally, dedicating housing units for households with homeless experience who are referred from the community's coordinated entry system. This is something that has continued through our RFP and continued to have been a focus over several years now. So as far as requirements and preferences, we have nine main areas, and there are seven that have really distinct requirements and preferences. So I just want to touch on those really, really briefly, more what those areas are than what the specific requirements and preferences are. We can stop and talk about that in the RFP document if anyone would like to. But first, for planning principles and consistency, in this RFP draft, we have one requirement or preference, and that is folks talk to and work with planning and really take that feedback and integrate it into their development proposals. We just have four requirements and five preferences related to the overall unit mix and the affordability of the units, four requirements related to property management, two requirements and three preferences related to supportive housing. Three requirements and six preferences related to sustainability and resilience, three requirements and four preferences related to design and accessibility, and then three requirements and two preferences related to the overall development team and financing, the financing that they would be requesting of the city. As you know, one of the requirements and preferences is also our Affordable Housing Fund target area map. So this is something that we talked about in detail at the last CDBG committee meeting, went over it, the highlights of it, and had a little bit of a discussion about it. No major changes from last year, but this is ready to go, updated as part of this RFP process as well. It really is one of the things that most closely guides the location of where these developments ultimately end up. So just a few highlights of things that are within this year's RFP. So one is a continued focus on affordable unit production. For us, those rental units, anything that we consider to be affordable is 60% AMI or under, but really also a focus on those 30% AMI units. Those are units that otherwise really wouldn't be produced in the market, even through housing tax credit development in most cases, without a significant city involvement within the financial structure of those developments. Continued focus on long-term affordability, a requirement of at least 40 years for Allura, maintaining that. That's a land use restriction agreement, and also having a permanent option for developers to be able to choose should they want to commit to maintaining those units as income and rent restricted units in perpetuity. A continued focus on tenant selection standards, again, reducing barriers that folks have who would otherwise be great tenants to getting into rental housing. A focus on quality property management and training. We'll talk about this a little bit in the RFP section. A continued focus on supportive housing and integrated supportive housing as well. So, providing housing opportunities for people with homeless experience. And new this year, having a preference or an option for folks to choose a hard set aside, as opposed to a soft set aside. That is, instead of a small period of time that those units are held vacant, trying to find a tenant, they could potentially be held open indefinitely. And that's due to a change through the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority. A continued geographic focus with our preferred TOD areas, and then a continued preference for our nonprofit and emerging developer partners that we see from time to time in the city that come through for funding access. So, of note to the committee, there are several things coming up on the calendar to keep an eye out for. You might want to pencil these in on your own calendars. They're fun dates. There are some times for us to get together. First is August 28th, and that is, assuming there's an asterisk there, depending on when we get the RFP actually published, that is the anticipated date that applications would be due. So that's just about 6.5 weeks from now, but really looking, kicking off this process quickly to get applications back in. On October 9th, we have scheduled applicant presentations to the CDBG committee. We had talked about hosting this as an in-person meeting to have applicants and proposers come in to Madison Municipal Building to provide a little bit more face-to-face time to be able to ask questions, have discussions, talk with proposers. And then December 4th is when we anticipate that we would be bringing staff recommendations for funding to you as the CDBG committee for action, and then forwarding that on to Common Council for final action on funding recommendations. And then in March 2028, you will receive, every March, you receive a housing overview presentation of what we saw and what we helped fund in housing that opened over the previous year. Because of the timeline of development deals, even if one comes in that's, ready to start construction right away next spring, it would probably be until the March 2028 meeting that you would see us come before you and say, "Hey, this building opened. You helped select it, you helped help guide the funding through this process, and here's the end result of it." Just to illustrate some of the length of the timelines for these proposals that we see. And finally, I just want to touch on one last thing, which is, like I said, this is the 12th consecutive year that we've run this program. So we are very much looking forward as staff and as a division to continuing to add developments and affordable units and supportive housing units to this table. But probably could have put this in the background section. Just want to talk about where we've been so far. So in total, we've had 35 projects come through this committee, submit through this process, with almost 3,000 total units created and nearly 2,400 affordable units created, with just over 630 of those being supportive housing units. So just like to center this again every year and say, this program has had such a large impact and is helped shaped by folks on the committee. So looking forward to coming back and continuing to show updates on this table and talk about it. All right, please forgive me while I switch screens here and share one more time.
While you're doing that, Ben, just for the minutes, Alder Harrington McKinney has joined.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Okay, so I'm not going to go into detail on everything that is within the RFP document as a draft. We did have that updated, but I just want to say, there was a significant amount of work that went into making this a little bit more navigable. And usable for staff and for proposers as well. So we have 14 pages for the draft in front of you. I have already corrected the typo. There is not 122 pages in the table of contents. So that was an oops. But other than that, it's pretty clearly broken out into sections. So would encourage folks to just, continue to look at it, glance at it, maybe look at the table on page 4 to remind yourselves to pick out those key dates of some of the things that we're working on in the background as staff too, and how that ultimately leads into those applicant presentations and staff funding recommendations to council. But other than that, there are two main sections to the RFP. So there's the overview section, which, as I talked about, contains the scope of the RFP, the policy guidance, the program's main goals and objectives being, preserving, developing, and dedicating housing units for households with homeless experience. A section on the amount available funding, our financing amount and terms, and then we roll into the requirements and preferences section. So where I was listing those sections out before, this really is it. The first part of that is eligible applicants. Obviously, with the name of the RFP, the eligible applicants are proposers who want to build affordable rental housing developments and leveraging low-income housing tax credits. So this is distinct from our every other year process, which is our non-tax credit proposals. Again, have to be leveraging tax credits through this process. Section 2 then is our geographic eligibility, as we talked about our Affordable Housing Fund target area map. And ensuring that developments ultimately are guided to where we as a city have committed to wanting to put new developments. Again, planning principles and plan consistency, unit mix and affordability carries through that theme of wanting to see as much affordability as possible within these units. And then I do just want to stop and talk for a second about the property management section here. So we have in the past required, developers form partnerships with property managers, with support service providers, and come to us with a proposal that includes those elements as components of a holistic whole. We want to make sure that everything is integrated, folks are working together, that they understand the needs of the communities they serve, and help utilize those different insights to ultimately inform the design and the programming of the building. One of the things that we want to ensure, especially, the development environment has shifted, and you've heard Director O'Keefe talk about this several times, where we used to see a lot of what are called 9% tax credit deals, which are smaller in scale, 60 to 80 units, or 4% and 4 and 4 deals, which are leveraging a smaller federal credit and then a state credit, which can get a little bit larger. But we're starting to see a lot of straight 4% deals. And what we want to ensure is as those number of units increase, because with straight 4% deals, you can sometimes get 200, 300, potentially 400 units within a building. We really want to take a strong look and ensure that quality property management is attached to those proposals if they're being contemplated for city funding. So we have provided some guidelines within the property management section this year. Just these are requirements to ensure that as proposers come through the process, they are intricately aware on the front end of our expectations as a city in how they will respond to tenant concerns, work with tenants, and then potentially also work with the city as well as we continue to navigate some of these processes. All right, so finally, we do have our supportive housing sections, our sustainability and resilience section, and then our design and accessibility section, and then development team and financing. So that is really the bulk of the RFP document itself, is just really trying to upfront and make clear what those requirements and preferences are for folks who are responding, and then scoring criteria as well. So our scoring criteria do tie directly back to our requirements and preferences, though would note, as always, when we talk about this committee, that scoring criteria are used really as a first pass by an interdisciplinary staff review team to sort of differentiate proposals and move forward ones for further evaluation that we would consider with funding. This is not where we would score all proposals and then go down the list and say, the top, five, whatever we have funding for, move forward. It really is a little bit more nuanced than that. And these just move forward, which ones would be considered for that further evaluation, further questions, which is where some of our supplemental application questions come in, staff team reviews, and then ultimately the presentations to committee as well. So I am. I have to stop sharing one more time. Could have planned this better. and just pull up the memo here. So I'm not going to go into detail on this, but we did list out many of the changes that were included within the document from last year to this year, just to make it easier for committee to go through. I know that I get in the process of, I get used to looking at the same thing all of the time, and sometimes when things shift a little bit, I'm like, where did that go? So just wanted to make it easier for all of you. So if you haven't had a chance to review this fully yet, I think it does provide a little bit of additional context on what some of the changes were from last year to this year, and then the reasoning for why we made those changes. Been talking longer than I intended already. So with that, I think I'm going to leave it there, and would defer back to you, Chair, if there are any questions or comments.
Thanks, Matt. Tried my camera again, still not working. So this is what it is tonight. Questions from the committee for Matt or other staff on the RFP? Angie.
Yes, thank you so much, Chair. I just had one question. So I understood all of the other changes that were being made. And on the bottom of page two, where you talk about the removal of blanket preference for missing middle style development, and then there is the more elaborate explanation, which I just didn't get. So could you just put that in layman's term for me?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank
So
you.
in last year's RFP, and for several years prior to that, when we list out requirements and preferences, those apply to in most cases to everyone who applies. So we had a preference that said we have a preference for missing middle style development as a component of your proposal. In many cases, that would mean, like an apartment style building, maybe three or four stories, with a bank of townhomes. Or something with more of like a smaller scale, maybe two-story development style. Like when you walk up to it, it has the same visual impact in height as like a single-family home. What we've realized through this process is our colleagues down in the planning division, they do pre-application meetings with us for all of the people who propose to this RFP. And it's really frequent during those meetings, even outside of the ones we're in, just in the general development process, that planning will say, well, with plan recommendations, it really says you should scale up or include some more smaller scale development on this portion of the site. And so we didn't want to imply that every single site in the city is the same, right? And would have to include some sort of missing middle style development. But we're really deferring to the planning principles, and consistency is now broken out this year as its own scoring section like it wasn't before. And so if people respond to that, if planning staff say, this is actually a really great site that does call for some missing middle style development or something that's a little bit lower density, allow developers the opportunity to include components of that and really just score it in a separate category, without disallowing developers who don't have the ability within their proposal to include it in the first place to sort of like miss out on the preference or miss out on points with it.
So, in other words, it's just really letting people know that not every single development that needs to be that's being developed here in the community, it doesn't need to be part of the missing middle, essentially.
I think that's a fair statement.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Right, Megan?
Thank you, Chair, and thanks, Matt. A comment and a question. The comment is just, I was excited to see the play space included and as a requirement. So I've been learning more about the importance of that, especially for young people, and thought that was a great addition. And then the question is, you mentioned at the beginning that there's $10 million approximately available this year. And I was just curious how that relates to previous years.
Yes, and I may need to call on some help from Director O'Keefe for this one. So last year, I know was a same amount, $10 million approximately available. Prior to that, my memory is honestly a little bit hazy, and I would have to go back in my records, though I assume Director O'Keefe would have that readily available.
And you would be wrong, Matt. But it's consistent. There has been an upward trend over the last few years. I think we've been settled in at around that $10 million mark. That the number can fluctuate a little bit in those years in which we award funds to development proposals that might not secure tax credits and so return those funds. But we've been consistent, pretty consistent in this range of about $10 million. Remember, the Affordable Housing Fund supports, as Matt mentioned, not just this RFP process, which is all about tax credit developments, but a number of other affordable housing activities as well. So, but I'm sorry, I don't have the specific dollar amounts from one year to the next, but we've been reasonably stable the
Not
last few years.
drastically different. Thank you.
Great. Alder, you care?
Thank you, Chair. And it's another question for Matt. Made me think about it when you were talking about the strengthening of the section on management for larger projects, how that concern and the ability of management to handle these larger projects was involved. It occurs to me the same kind of level of staffing could be an issue for the requirements for the availability of services, particularly to that 30% and lower group or the near, recently homeless and so forth. Do we have a way to take a look at the level of service, usually these nonprofit partners that we are brought in by the developer? Do we have a way to consider whether they're going to be able to staff it adequately?
Yes, and you are already getting into application questions. So those are things that we ask on the application because they have in most cases a memorandum of understanding with the developer. And so we let them work out and really negotiate what services, what populations they provide services to, how that fits in with the development, what level of funding they need for that, do they need a space on site? What does staffing look like? And so those are things that we tell people that we want through this RFP. And then as they come in to fill out their application, the things that you asked are exactly questions that we have on our application and take under consideration as a review team. And you will see those applications as well that do say, where are services going to be provided? How much funding is being made available? What number of FTEs will be available to provide those services and some of the plans associated with it. Newly this year, we're also requiring that a support service plan actually be submitted with the application itself. And so we're expecting to get quite a bit more detail this year on what some of the things you're asking about ultimately will end up looking like.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you, Alder Yeager. Matt, I had one question on the final change noted about the permanent kind of set aside for people experiencing homelessness. I understand we're doing that to mirror WIDA's QAP, but I'm curious, as a developer in the environment, does that make me more likely to have those set asides or less likely to have those set asides because it will be harder for me to fill and therefore make my cost make sense. That make sense?
I think so.
Okay.
So I think it largely depends on the developer and the mission of the developer and what they're trying to bring forward. One of the things that we stress in this RFP process is unique and creative proposals. That's a little bit hard sometimes, especially with some of the requirements that we have, that WIDA has, but we try and encourage folks to do it. That's something that we've included because we believe it is both unique and creative. But with WIDA's change to their qualified allocation plan, that's the plan of how they administer tax credits. We honestly, I think it's safe to say, don't know yet, because we haven't included this in our process and asked the question and gotten the information. So last year's cycle was the first year that anyone claiming points in supportive housing for WIDA would have to have some form of rental subsidy or ongoing operating subsidy associated with those units and make those a hard set aside. So we just don't have enough experience because it's too recent of a change to know whether this is something that anyone has taken advantage of to make their tax credit application more attractive to WIDA.
Got it. That makes sense. Thanks. Any other questions or comments from the committee? Megan.
Sorry, one more question.
That's okay.
We've talked a little bit about the preferred locations in the past meetings. And not here to debate that at all, but because that's been a little bit contentious, would we ever seek out information from tenants to see if that's helpful? Do you know what I mean? Like if it's serving them to be in areas that are closer to BRT or to the bus?
I mean, like if they're actually using public transportation. Try, Matt.
Sure. So we work very closely with our partners in development of this RFP process. Like I said, there's an interdisciplinary staff review team. It's economic development, planning. We work with folks in zoning and sustainability and really try and integrate a lot of different city initiatives together to try and make the most appealing and attractive developments that we possibly can. I mean, I hear what you're saying, and I think, do we need new development in general, regardless of location? Like, yes, absolutely. But we also have our guiding policy documents, right? So we have our planning division who went through the Imagine Madison comprehensive planning process and all of the area plans, and are really focused on infill development, you know, development of underutilized sites on those high frequency transit lines. And then we have put in place things like the transit oriented development zoning overlay to make it easier to build in places where we have planned for. And I don't mean to imply that those plans are created in a vacuum either, right? There is extensive community engagement that goes into those planning processes. And so thousands and thousands of members of the public were engaged through the Imagine Madison planning process. And a lot of those questions were being asked. So in a lot of ways, we work with our colleagues in planning who do community engagement as a major component of their job all of the time. And have reinforced and have heard this feedback about living on transit lines, make it easier to get places. The other side of that that I would call in is we do talk to especially our support service providers in these developments and have regular conversations with them, because there's the double side of it is we need affordable housing. We also need affordable housing for our most vulnerable residents, right? Folks who have potentially the lowest incomes have need for other support services. And what we've generally heard loud and clear is that living on or near transit, where you don't even necessarily have to check a schedule sometimes to get into your job, is something that's beneficial for people. Whether that's beneficial for everyone, I don't think that that's true that it's beneficial for everyone. But I think it's good to have that option. And that's really what we focus in on as a city, is trying to create options for people to make it easier to get around, to make it more sustainable to get around. And with some of Metro's transit network redesigns as well, make it more reliable to get around. So it's really about stacking different initiatives that we've put forward.
That's great. Thank you.
Thanks. Any other questions, comments from the committee? Scrolling, although I don't need to because I have everyone's. I think then we're all set. It's not a decision item. The RFP is going out on the timeline Matt said. We'll have presentations in October. I hope we can make that an in-person meeting because I just think it's a little more valuable, although I know it's more tricky for folks to make it work. And then recommendations for approval in December on this one. So a long process, but a good process. Do we have a staff report tonight, Jim? I see one on the agenda.
Yeah, there is one on the agenda. I just want to mention two items briefly. First, because you may hear about it, The Dairy Drive campground that was set up in the fall of 2021 is scheduled to come to an end on September 30th of this year. This is a facility, the first legal campground in the city of Madison that was set up in the wake of the pandemic and the development of other illegal and unsafe arrangements in public parks, most notably at Rindle Park. When this was set up, we thought that we would be able to carry it for 2 years. So we'll make about 4 years, but it has leaned very, very on federal funds to sustain it. And those funds, like so many of the other funds that we've had access to in recent years, those funds are now depleted. And so we are working with the service provider for an orderly wind down of that campground again by September 30th. There's been a little bit of talk about trying to find resources to extend the life of the campground. I've not seen a viable plan to do so. So we're proceeding with plans to close it by September 30th. And that leads to the second point that I want to make, because our focus when it comes to finances in the 2026 budget is all about the new men's shelter that is currently under construction and scheduled to open sometime in the spring of 2026. And so agency budget recommendations are due to Mayor Rhodes Conway at the end of this week. It is largely a cost to continue budget, but the mayor has left the door open to supplemental requests that pertain to or some way related to new facilities, new city facilities, and the new shelter on Bartolin Drive certainly qualifies for that. And we are contemplating how we will formulate our recommendations, but we'll certainly be looking for additional resources to help support its operation when it opens next year. So stay tuned for that. That's all.
Thanks, Jim. Any questions from Jim from the committee? I see. Alder Harrington McKinney, please.
Thank you so very much, and pardon my being late. Jim, could you tell us, and I really want to look at the area that is over on Dairy Drive, and I understand that that was a lot of ARPA funding. How much of do you have the numbers of how much money came from federal funds, ARPA, and then how much did the city have to put in to sustain it through the period of time from open to potential close?
Alder, I won't have very, very precise numbers, but I can tell you that the city spent about $1 million to set that facility up to purchase the 30 pallet shelters, to put in the infrastructure for water and sewer, a trailer that provided bathrooms and showers. Each of the units was connected to its own electrical power source. There were other site improvements made, fencing and so on. So it was about $1 million in all to set it up. A little bit of that money came from tax increment financing, but most of it came from federal dollars that we received from the federal government related to COVID-19. And then the sustaining the operations, that has been anywhere between about $700,000 and $900,000 a year to manage the property and to support on-site services to folks that have utilized the campground. We have spent little or no city dollars. When I say city dollars, I mean general levy funds. But rather, we have redirected, you and your colleagues, Alder, have redirected a good deal of ARPA funding to support the operations of the campground. There was a small federal grant application that was secured about 3 years ago, that to the tune of about $199,000 a year. And in the last 2 years, Dane County put forward $175,000, just shy of that, $175,000 for each of the last 2 years, as the federal funds at the city administered began to dwindle. We were picked up a little bit by that injection of county funding. So I don't have the very, very precise, but very little direct city dollars. Our contribution to the campground has been through federal funds that we've been charged with administering, mostly
Okay,
ARPA.
thank you very much. And then my final question is this, is anything salvageable? And I was taking copious notes in terms of the projected shutdown of the site, and building the site and the investment in the site. Is anything recoupable? Is there something that's there that we can move forward and reuse? Or what is the plan for when the site officially closes? And then I'll be complete with your answer.
Again, a very good question, Alder. We have Lynette and I toured that site maybe a little about 2 months ago, to sort of assess what's there and what, if anything, might be salvageable. It will be our colleagues in facilities management in the engineering division that will take the lead on returning this site to the state that it was in prior to our use of it. They'll take a hard look at the trailer that's been used for showers and bathrooms and office facilities, and the pallet shelters themselves to see if any of those might be salvageable. And it's very likely that if any of that is usable going forward, that it'll be offered up to Occupy Madison, who is, as you know, supports a number of sites around the city that uses similar small structures to provide housing opportunities for clients that they work with. So it isn't it's a little bit too early to know which, if any, of those shelters, small shelter structures, might be usable. But some may. And we'll have to evaluate that as the process of disassembling the site begins.
Thanks, Jim. Alder Harrington and McKinney, any other questions? Right. Any other questions or comments for Jim? I don't see any, so I think. Oh, Angie, go ahead. No, you're fine.
Sorry, I know I'm standing between us and being able to go.
We're
I
still
just,
like before we usually start. I mean, so it's.
yeah, very, very true. Quick question. Regarding Dairy Drive, I'm assuming that the closure is anticipated by the participants and that there has been some due diligence in making sure that they have a space to be able to go. I know they try very hard to get them placed into housing, but for those who are not able to find housing before it closes on September 30th, is there a plan to help get them housed, or do they just return to the streets? I know that's not what we want, but is there anything in the works on that?
Yeah, it certainly is not what we want. So we've been working toward this end. The end of that campground has been clear for some time, and we've been in clear communication with Madison Street Medicine and CAVA Recovery Services, the on-site providers, to begin the process of preparing. There have been a number of housing resources that have been made available to folks that have been using the campsite. Some, my numbers are correct, some 10 sustainability vouchers, which is a version of the Section 8 housing voucher. And I believe it's five slots for rapid rehousing. So there is a concerted effort underway that has been underway for some time to try to help people get into housing that are at that site or to find other arrangements. I wish I could tell you that that will be successful for everybody and anybody that is currently using the site. We've gotten some reports that a handful of residents have declined offers of housing. We've also been working with the new owner of the Enzo apartment building, the former Rethke Terrace. So there are some opportunities and everything that can be done to connect people to those opportunities, I think will be done. But it's certainly possible that that some folks, either by choice or by lack of choice, may return to homelessness when the campground closes.
And everyone there is single, right? There's no families living at Dairy Drive, right?
There are no families, never have been at Dairy Drive. There have been over the years. I don't know if it's the case now. It has been available to couples, but in that case, the two members of a partnership or pair have had their own cabins. So there are no more than 29 people, maximum of 29 people that are currently using that site.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Angie. Looking, any more comments, questions? Seeing none, we will take a motion for adjournment. Thank you, Alder, Dean, and Nina. Second by Megan. We stand adjourned. Thanks, everyone. Have a great Monday night.